This morning we're going to talk about hunger, and I've titled it, What Do We Mean Hunger? Putting the word hunger in quotes, because I think what we do in response to the reality of hunger really depends on how we define it. And there are many different definitions of hunger, and they're all true. They all may be true. H.L. Mencken, the famous journalist in Baltimore earlier in this century, once said, for every complex problem in the world, there's a simple solution, and it's always wrong. And I think that's true with hunger. A lot of people have simple solutions to hunger. You've heard some of them. What are they? You know, one-line solutions. If they would only, they the hungry. Go to work. What else?
Have less kids.
Thinking of third world particularly. Have fewer babies. Control their population growth. That's a favorite one of ours.
In a special way. In fact, I first heard the word stewardship in Iowa farm country, referring not to contributions for the mission of the church, which is the way
most people in poor countries know how to farm, but they don't have the inputs or the incentives to produce.
And the book has as a presupposition.
It's fairly popular today among the rich. If we would use less, if we would consume less, if we would simplify our lifestyle, that, some say, would solve the hunger problem. Well, I don't think it would. It's a part of the solution, perhaps, and all of these simple solutions may be a part of the answer, but they
land as good as I found it or better. That's the biblical understanding of the use of the land, the nurturing of the earth, caretaking of the earth, both soil and water, so that the earth may continue to sustain life long after a particular farmer.
For that understanding, determine what comes farther down the grid, and I think it may help you to organize a rather complex body of material, and we'll get to that in a minute. Let me first say some introductory things. The biblical material on bread and hunger and poverty and justice and the faithfulness of the people of God and of God's concern for justice for the hungry is massive. There is just an overwhelming amount of material in the Bible. One recent book that I want to mention to you, I have a number of them on the table back there for you to look at. I pulled them out of the library or the bookstore so that they'd be here for you to review. One recent book that gathers all the biblical material related to hunger, poverty, and justice together and organizes it according to themes is called Cry Justice. And it was put together by Ron.
Well, that's really not true in any meaningful sense. Most of the world's people eat the food.
And it's all Bible stuff with a little bit of discussion helps added to it. But the neat thing about it is that it gathers it together according to themes. Somebody who studies that kind of thing claims that every sixth verse in the Bible, one verse in every six, deals with hunger, poverty, economic justice. I haven't counted myself. I'll take that scholar's word for it. It is pretty clear, to me at least, that in the Bible, the test of faithfulness to God, very often, the test of faithfulness, whether or not I have faith, whether the community has faith, is how do you treat the poor and the hungry? How do you respond to the needs of those, the physical needs of those who are needy? Let me just give you a few biblical references for that. There are many, many, many more. But two from each testament, and they may not all be familiar to all of us. One from
country to country. That's the distinction that I'm drawing. So in the first chapter, we talk about the relationship.
And it's interesting because it's a reference to Sodom. And most people, what was the sin of Sodom in your mind? What did it have to do with? Sexual excess, sexual abuse, sexual perversion, right? In fact, the English word sodomy comes from Sodom. From the city of Sodom. But listen to what Ezekiel says. This is in Ezekiel 16:49. Behold, this was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters had pride, surfeit of food, that is, sufficiency of food, or more than enough food, and prosperous ease, but did not aid the poor and needy. No reference there to sexual excess at all. The guilt of Sodom, at least in Ezekiel's mind in this passage, was that Sodom had plenty but didn't take care of the needy. Another Old Testament passage, Isaiah 58, in which the Lord Yahweh speaks through the prophet and says about fasting, the kind of fast I like, the kind of fast that pleases me, is that you share your bread with the hungry and break the chains of oppression and injustice. That's the kind of fasting I appreciate.
I could say farmers don't appreciate that too much. They don't like to be included in the same bill with the recipients.
He feed you when you were hungry? Well, when you did it to one of the least of these. And
because there's a political trade-off going on, the farmers' representatives in Congress are
God. It is as though you are ministering to Jesus himself.
And then James depended on in Congress to vote the interests of farmers, economic interests of farmers, declines.
In which the writer says, what does it profit if a man says he has faith but has not works? Can his faith save him? And then the clincher is, if a brother or sister is ill-clad and in lack of daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warm and be filled, without giving them the things needed for the body, what does it profit? What good is accomplished? So faith by itself, if it has no works, is dead. So the test of faithfulness very often in the scriptures is in terms of providing bread for the hungry. It's hard, I think, this is still introductory, I want to make one other point. It has to do with dependency. It is hard for people who have never really hungered to understand hunger. And I'm among that company. I have never really gone hungry for any prolonged amount of time. A few years back, our family decided that we would fast for a day and give the money saved by not consuming that day to the World Hunger Fund of our denomination. And we decided to do that at Thanksgiving time, because Thanksgiving time is when many churches emphasize hunger and the needs of the hungry. And we decided, okay, we'd do it, but not on Thanksgiving Day, because we weren't quite ready to give up turkey and all of that. So we ate very well, as we all do in America, it seems, on Thanksgiving Day. And then the next day or the Saturday following, we
military spending by this country. That sustains our military establishment for 3 weeks.
It may be a mistake that the Christian tradition in the West has abandoned the custom of fasting. Fasting became a legalism for many, including the Roman Catholic Communion, and the Second Vatican Council decided not to make it an obligation anymore, but to make it voluntary. Well, very few do it voluntarily. But I think the practice of fasting, which is still alive in some faiths, Islam makes very much of fasting, is probably a good discipline, a good spiritual discipline. Going without material things is a good spiritual discipline, because it helps us to identify with those who have no choice
for survival. People always ask, what is a family farm?
Most humanity in most of human history has been to know hunger, at least at some time during a life, if not at some time during every day or every week. It is still common for about half of the human population today. Roughly half of the human population today is not secure with regard to food. That doesn't mean that 2 billion people every day are hungry. It means they're not secure, as we are, with regard to food. About 1 in 8, the estimates are, of the world's population, which would be 500 million, 500 million, are in chronic undernutrition. That is, they go through most of a lifetime not getting enough to eat all of the time. That does not mean they're starving today. It means they're dying slowly of starvation from the moment they're born. Well, to be human, to have the experience of being human, I think, is to know hunger. And it is unfortunate that most of us do not experience hunger. I'm not wishing
of U.S. farming. Second part is the structure. Third part is the style or manner, and that includes
when we can satisfy our hunger almost without thought, without pain or labor or struggle, and that's true for most of us in this room, I think. Food has become so plentiful.
Topsoil has been used up in 120 years of farming, since the plow was,
as machines do at mealtime, with seldom a reflection. We have to push ourselves to reflect on how that...
Well, it's used up not by growing things from it, but by practices which lead to its erosion
on that table. So I think hunger brings two realities into clear focus, or it ought to. We ought to think of it in this way. One is our dependence on God. And we say those words occasionally. I don't know how often we reflect deeply about it. That we are dependent all the time, every day, for food and other things as well, on God's bounty.
which have been abandoned in the last 30 years in the name of all-out production and monocropping or planting.
Nature of nature, the daily seasonal cycle of production of food, not only from the land but from the waters, from the streams, which is part.
There won't be any topsoil left in a state like Iowa.
It's not realistic, though, to really say.
People will be sustained. With proper husbandry, all of the food scientists today agree. There is enough food in the world to feed everybody. There is enough food produced annually to give adequate nutrition to everyone in the world, and probably twice the population the world now has. The problem is not the Earth's productive capacity. We haven't yet exhausted that. It is maldistribution. It is that some of us do consume more than we need, or have the land of other people used to meet our needs, our frivolous needs, when the people in those places are not being fed from that land. We'll get to that in a minute on the chart. So hunger brings two realities to mind. One is our dependence on God, and the other, I think, is our dependence on one another. Other human beings who gather and grow and transport and process and prepare our food for us. Increasingly, we don't do all of the food preparation in our own homes for meals we eat there. Some of it is already prepared when we buy it. It is semi-prepared. I'm not just thinking of carry-out or carry-in food from the local chow mein place or the local pizza place. I'm thinking of foods in the grocery stores, too. All of the diverse support structures that are in place now to produce and get food to us, we don't very often reflect about that. Incidentally, when we complain about the price of food today, in most cases, we ought not blame the farmer.
As long as energy was cheap, petroleum energy, we didn't worry too much about how much energy it takes.
The price of food is in where? Is in what area?
Labor.
After it leaves the farmer's gate, after it is food as a raw material, and before it gets to our table. Because less and less of.
We have normally, in the United States, like to talk about efficiency in terms of production per worker.
Necessary work done to food, but for packaging and advertising and for all sorts of middle area things that we could do without. But they do provide jobs for people. I guess you can say at least that for.
Produces, how much food one farm worker produces, or how many people one farm worker produces for.
Complex. It has become, in fact, a national and then an international system of getting food to us. Overseas peoples whose labor and land provide food for us. We sometimes, one of the simple solutions is American farmers produce more food than we need, therefore we ought to provide more food aid. We ought to send more food from America overseas, or at least we ought to sell more food from America overseas. Well, that's a partial answer again. What is often overlooked is that much of the rest of the world provides food for us, and we import food as well as export food to the world. I would like to stop here and ask for you to tick off the foods and beverages that you know and that you probably consume daily or at least once a week, which come from other parts of the world because the United States can't produce them. What are they?
Bananas.
Chocolate.
Coffee.
Bananas.
Tea.
Spices.
Many, many spices.
McDonald's.
Yeah, most of our fast food beef now is imported. Did you know that?
Australia.
Because that's cheaper. Grass-fed beef from Australia or even more Central America, grazing on land there, is cheaper for us to import than to buy domestic grain-fed beef. Most of our domestic beef is at least partially grain-fed. And that bothers some of our local livestock producers in this country. But a lot of our beef comes from imports. What else?
Bananas.
Bananas was mentioned.
Cheese.
Cheese?
No.
Well, there is some cheese is imported, yeah. But we also produce a lot of cheese domestically. A lot of sugar is imported. Not all, but much sugar. Where does it come from?
Hawaii. Cuba.
Probably not Cuba currently, although it used to.
What grain is used to make fuel? I mean, is it?
Currently, it's corn.
I mean, is it corn?
Because of increased labor costs, is now coming from the Philippines. The companies have moved to the Philippines. Can you think of other foods that we get from abroad?
Fish.
Dates.
Pineapple.
Dates. No, tapioca.
You can use the nutrient to produce gasohol, but you don't have to. Yeah.
Well, it can use either.
What about vegetables? Do all of our vegetables year-round come from California and Florida?
Mexico.
A lot of vegetables now in the northern markets come from the land south of us. Tomatoes, fresh tomatoes from Mexico. I saw a sign in a supermarket in Minneapolis a year or so ago in the middle of winter, January. Fresh tomatoes. Sign said, "To you from Mexico with love." And I really wondered who in Mexico, somebody in Mexico probably was happy that we were buying their tomatoes. But other people in Mexico perhaps were not, because land that was once used to grow food for Mexicans was now used to grow food for me. And then I reflected on whether I really needed fresh tomatoes.
But I'm told that gasohol can be produced without destroying the nutritive value of the grain. Another controversy, which has a chapter devoted to it, is chemicals.
Or don't have access to the land in their own control. It will be used to grow food for people who can buy, and that's been increasingly happening. There are many examples of land of basically poor countries being used to grow export crops for us, food for our market. Not only us, but Canadians, Europeans, Japanese, all of the northern wealthy countries.
An issue, I don't know, maybe that you'll talk about.
We go through it, I think you can follow, because we'll tell you what I'm basically going to do is fill in a word or a phrase, a short phrase, in each of the blanks.
Can I ask a question, Chuck?
Yeah.
The use of land and, let's say, the less developed countries for export purposes. One of the things that we discover happening whenever, let's say, in Africa, new nations being established in a new country.
How are we going to support farmers' conversion?
Not only that, but most organic farming, at least in the short run, studies indicate it produces less. The farmer comes out the same because the input costs are less. The farmer doesn't have to spend all that money on expensive chemicals. But the...
It's not necessarily the fact that we are greedy.
That's right.
It's the fact that there is a need.
They need an exporter.
Yeah,
that's something we're going to get to, Christy, in this third column. It's a problem,
including chemical fertilizer, ought to be in the developing world, not in the developed world. We should.
You can't really continue to trade for very long unless there's a trade-off. Most of the export
and parts of the world that are not using any chemicals, or very little, probably need to increase, because the additional purchase, the additional yield you get from putting another.
And with Zambia and Zaire, it's copper. That's their main export earner. But with many of the low-income countries, it's an agricultural product. And so it isn't, as you say, it isn't just our market greed or unsatisfied, frivolous desires for more sweet things and vegetables and drink and all that. It's also their need to have an export earner. And how you break that pattern.
I don't know how much energy it requires to make
basically, either agricultural or mine products for the industrial countries of the world, and don't manufacture their own things, you're going to have that kind of a pattern. What they're asking for increasingly is that they be allowed to process their own goods at home and then sell them to us and employ their own people to process them. And the problem with that is we resist it because it's our jobs they're talking about. And we'll get into that in this third column. What I want to do here, and I think once you catch the premise, you can all pretty much fill it in yourselves, is take three different understandings of what is the problem of hunger, what causes hunger. The first and most elementary one is the one we most often think about, I believe, when we don't go into any sophisticated analysis. It's what the press tends to treat as hunger. It's the problem of hunger as famine. Emergency need, immediate starvation. When it gets to the front pages of the newspapers, that's usually the understanding or the reality of hunger that is being dealt with. Hunger as famine. Visual images associated with that. Well, let me just ask first about famines or emergency problems with food that you're aware of in the world in the last year, year and a half.
Cambodia.
Cambodia, okay? Famine there was caused by what? Was it drought?
War.
It was civil disturbance. War. Civil war. It was human-created famine, as opposed to a natural disaster-caused famine. Can you think of any natural disaster-caused famines?
Droughts
anywhere in the world, where currently?
Was, as a kid, working on farms in the summertime in Iowa. Almost all the farms then in Iowa.
Through that Sahel region of sub-Sahara Africa, there is a continuing problem with lack of...
from the livestock went back on the land, and there was rotation of the crops, too. You didn't plant everything in corn.
Ethiopia and Somalia, currently.
Overpopulation is one of the...
In that region, too many people trying to make a living from the land because there's overgrazing, and that causes desertification.
I remember it. And then the livestock, chickens, cows...
Yeah, but often politics and or political problems and natural causes mixed together here. About a year ago, this month, or a little earlier, late August, early September, there was a problem in a part of the world not far from us.
Guatemala?
Well, no, I'm thinking of the Caribbean.
Haiti.
You remember Hurricane David? Hurricane David, Dominican Republic, Haiti, Dominica, a few other islands. It was in the news maybe for 3 or 4 days, and then it went away. But they are still in the aftermath of that problem in that region. What visual images do we associate with famine? What kind of photographs does the press carry?
People with bones.
Okay, shriveled limbs. I saw Eric showing a distended stomach. Usually children. Starving babies is the kind of cliche photograph. It is true. It is real, but it has become a cliche, so I think we're almost immunized against the impact of it now because we've seen so many of them in the last 10 years. But the starving baby photo is the photo that depicts famine. What is the need? If famine is the problem, what is the need?
Food
when? Next growing season?
No.
Food now. The need is more food today.
By the way, isn't it food about 6 months ago? Because most of those pictures, food wouldn't help those people anymore.
Well, yeah, it probably was food 6 months earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's very perceptive. Though food today would still help some of the people who are in a famine situation. And so what you try to do if you're in a position to help, whether you're in a relief organization or an individual, is try to rush food in immediately. And there is a kind of immediate emotional response to that reality. The remedy, what do we call the remedy? More food today is, there's a word we use for that.
Relief.
Relief, exactly. Relief is the word. I want to stop there and say a little bit about that word. The word relief has come to take on something of a negative character, just as the word charity has. And I think that's because we're increasingly aware that relief or charity in themselves are not sufficient. But if famine is the problem, relief is the answer. And that's what you do. You provide relief. You do that if this is the level of the problem that you're working at.
Yes, but you've got to look at it from another standpoint.
But if you already, the thing is in our community is that if your family has already
been it.
Well, okay, that's a complication.
That's
yeah, very often the relief that is given doesn't get to the people who need it. And that leads to another point I want to make. Many of the churches, not only church, but other voluntary organizations, non-governmental agencies that respond to hunger in the world, have the name Relief in their title. Can you think of any? Lutheran World Relief. Catholic Relief Services.
I meant to ask at the outset, how many of you are currently engaged in farming?
They began... Most of them after World War II. Lutheran World Relief began around 1946. They began in a situation where relief was what was needed. And most of the relief work then was not in the third world, the developing nations. Where was it?
In the war devastation.
Yeah, mostly Europe. Some Asia, but mostly Europe. Some of those agencies now wish they had a different name because what they do today is not really...
What is it today? Do you know the percentage of our population today engaged in agriculture?
3%. About 15% of its total resources go for relief or emergency aid, and 85% for development, which is column two. And we'll get to that in a minute. I can remember also when in the 30s and 40s in Iowa, we didn't say people were on welfare, we said people were on relief. And there is still in the state of Minnesota what is called general relief. For people who don't qualify for any other kind of public assistance, they are on general relief. That's the word that's used. So the word is also used in our public life in that way. Relief is welfare. It is a handout. And without any shame, you say, if that's the need, that's what you do. But, as we'll see, there's a problem if relief is continued too long, a long-term consequence. Typical Bible texts that go with that kind of direct, one-on-one sharing of food. What do you think of? What biblical material? Can you think of any?
When I was hungry, you fed me.
Okay, okay.
It's a neighbor hunger.
All right.
Two colts, get one cheese.
Okay. There's a lot of biblical material. I suppose even the one of the parables Jesus told, though, it doesn't deal with food. It deals more with health care on the highway, the Good Samaritan. The image there is of immediate response to need as you see it. And Matthew 25 is mentioned. What do people study if they go to the university and want to study the problem of inadequate food in the area of famine? What sorts of things do they look at? Probably not so much economics as in a later column here, but they may look at economics. But what do you know about the causes of famine, say, in the Sahel or in the Caribbean? Famine caused by natural disaster.
Agricultural control.
They look at climatology, geography, desertification is kind of a new subscience. What is it that causes the growth of deserts? Those sorts of things. Weather patterns and their relationship to famine, to drought. What motive or value, Christian value, is at work when we respond in this arena?
Love.
Bring the world back.
Love is a little too broad, because I think you could put love in all three. But what do we call the distinctive kind of loving that is to...
Compassion.
Okay. Compassion. There is a specific word that has come to be used there, and I mentioned it a little while ago.
Charity.
Charity, yeah. Charity, which is the love of sharing, usually from those who have more to those who have less. It's a kind of... It's a relationship of unequals in terms of power and material resource.
Isn't charity also just a little bit too broad? How about philanthropy?
All right, philanthropy. That's an interesting word, because that literally means love of humanity. Long-term consequence. If you continue the relief mode for very long,
dependence.
You create dependence. I have a friend, Hertha and I visited in Ethiopia in 1975, and the USAID official, Hertha, you remember him? We met with him on a Sunday afternoon. He happened to be a Lutheran. We met him at church that morning. He worked for the US government, for us, distributing food aid for people who were in a famine situation in Ethiopia. And he told us that their working rule of thumb was to try to discontinue the direct distribution of food in an emergency famine situation within 4 months. Because he said, if you go more than 4 months, we've found that becomes the new normalcy for people. And they tend to depend on it, and it's very hard to break them out of that dependency. So the long-term consequence of this response is dependency. And all who work in the area try to get over the hump of immediate relief as soon as they can.
That has become a real problem among the Eskimos in Alaska.
Has it?
It's
churches spend money.
Well, and we say the same thing about our domestic welfare program, that there are, in some cases, generation after generation, families that become dependent on that way of making it. And if there's another way, of course, we'd all prefer to get out of this response and into something else. Let's move to the second column here. We've got to move along. This one, the problem is defined not as famine, but as underdevelopment. I think that's the usual term. Now, there's a problem with that. I'll mention it. I don't know about substitute, so we'll use the word. But development implies that there are some people developed and other people's not developed, and that the poor are not developed, or that the model for their development is our development. And I just mentioned all those problems that go with the word, and then we'll continue to use the word because I don't have a good substitute for it. This column is dealing with agricultural development in particular. And it says the problem is lack of, for whatever reasons, lack of adequate agricultural development in the poor nations. This has a certain visual image that's associated with it too. What, it's not as obvious maybe as a starving baby, but what pictures or images, photographs, do you think of when you think of underdevelopment agriculturally?
What kind of implements are used for
hand? Maybe inadequate technology, okay? Technology that isn't what it could be to produce as much food as is needed. What else?
Plowing with a piece of wood.
Okay.
Hand labor.
There are some places where human motive power is still used to plow the land. And very often it's women, by the way, who pull the plow. Other places, maybe, where they could use small machine technology, they are not, whatever. I do not think, by the way, that the answer here in the area of technology is for them to have the big tractors we have, the Steiger tractors made in Fargo, North Dakota. That is not a solution either. We'll talk tonight about agriculture in China a little bit. One of the things we saw in China was that China has really found a good middle ground, an appropriate technology that keeps many, many people employed in agriculture and yet takes some of the backbreaking human labor out of agriculture. Many of the developing countries have to find a technology for agriculture that is suitable, that doesn't throw people out of work and send them all to urban areas where there's no work for them, that keeps them engaged in agriculture, but makes their labor more productive. Maybe that's a very interesting subject. Indians get rather irritated when Westerners mention that because they say the cow is not a worthless animal. It provides fertilizer, it provides milk, it provides, if not meat, it provides dairy products, and provides labor, because the cow is used as a motive, for motive power. And many Indians say, we don't eat the way you do anyway. Many are vegetarian, and so they don't need all the meat. I tend to view the cow as a problem for India, but I'd go a little careful there about, you know, making too much of that. Indians like to say, we have our sacred cows, you have your sacred cars. And you keep them right in your house with you. You drive them in under your house in the garage. And look at the resource they require to keep them going. So,
I've seen pictures where they use the blood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in some African tribes they do that. They keep the herds and use the blood for protein.
That's right. Also, the flies.
Fuel.
Yeah, it provides fuel, and that's right. One other thing here that you might mention in that, yeah.
You know, I think much of that problem there, the famine and all that, is a poor distribution of wealth. Few have much, and some have nothing. If you don't have the means for a loaf of bread, how are you going to eat it? You see what I mean? There's so many of them that don't have the means of cultivating their land because they don't have the money to even develop it.
Well, they don't even have access to land.
No.
Many of the poor of the low-income countries are landless people. They are rural, landless poor.
And then they're overpopulated.
Let's hold that a minute, because that's a kind of reform
that
we need to get to in column three.
Poor marketing procedures.
Okay. Another way of visualizing this might be, because very often the problems in underdeveloped agriculture are water related, might have to do with water. Lack of water control. Lack of dams or wells, of irrigation systems, which are often important in the tropical countries. or lack of enough water for agriculture when you need it. Because very often the water falls in developing countries at certain times during the year, and then it's dry for 10 months. It's a kind of monsoon pattern. So much of the work in agricultural development in low-income countries has to do with water. Water conservancy, water management. And a lot of the dollars that church people give to fight world hunger, in fact, are used to deal with water conservancy overseas. So the need is what? If underdevelopment in agriculture is the problem, what's the need? More food?
Better management.
Education.
Great. Teaching.
Okay. Think of the contrast with this. More food now. The focus is on more food when? It's on more production of food, and therefore next growing season, more food. More food tomorrow. The remedy we call, not relief, but development. Development includes many, many things. It's one reason the word is so slippery is that it's so all-inclusive. It's like hunger. Can you think of Bible texts that deal with development? By the way, it's another kind of jargon phrase that we've come to use. It's self-help, helping people to help themselves, which is distinct from relief. In relief, you don't even pretend to be helping people to help themselves. You're helping them to survive. But in development, you're helping people to help themselves. Good development does that.
How about the sower and the seed?
Okay.
Hezekiah's time to Jerusalem.
Okay. There's another parable that is often mentioned here as a kind of parable for development. Some call it the most capitalist parable, yeah, because it seems to reward investment and development. Parable of the talents. What do you study now? You don't so much study climatology, desertification, what creates famine. You study what sorts of things if agricultural development is the issue. Okay, so you look at seed science. Well-known Nobel science winner from Cresco, Iowa, who happens to be a Lutheran, some of you know the name, has devoted his life to what is called the Green Revolution. And what was that all about? And what's his name? Norman Borlaug. Grew up on a farm near Cresco, Iowa. What is the Green Revolution all about? It fits in column two. Higher yielding varieties of seed, whether it's rice, grain, maize, millet, whatever fits a particular country, primarily focused on the third world and on agricultural production, not dealing much with issues of land reform or justice within a country, that's another problem, but simply producing more and developing varieties of seeds that would produce more yield. So the whole Green Revolution technology fits here. And that's not just seeds, it's also water and fertilizer and all of the inputs for agriculture that will fit a particular region of the world.
This lady has an interesting slide on this a little bit, too, in her own country.
George Washington Carver with his peanuts and sweet potatoes.
Oh, yeah, sure. Good, good.
I would like to, I don't know where to come in. But we're talking about land. But what about the development of the seed? We farm the seed, which has got a bigger food source, they say, than our land in time. Oceanography says that we will be making use of the sea or the oceans much more.
Fish culture. Some of you may know that Holden is interested in exploring that and doing more, I guess, down at Lucerne is the hope, to do more with aquaculture. To produce food right here for consumption here. Yeah, the oceans, we've been not only over farming some of the land, we've been over farming some of the oceans lately so that the fish supply is not renewing itself. as fast as it once did through over-farming or over-fishing. But there's a lot of on-land fish farming now developing around the world where you have ponds that are under controlled circumstances and you fish farm. Okay, the motive or value here, what would you say? When we in the high-income countries try to help the low-income countries with their agricultural development, what motive is at work? We've said compassion and charity here. Is it really different? I think not. I think it's still basically compassion, sharing with the neighbor. And whether we support this kind of thing with private donations through voluntary agencies like Lutheran World Relief or with tax dollars through the U.S. government agencies, because we do both. We in fact do a lot more with tax dollars. We spend a lot more with tax dollars. Whether we get as much for the dollar is another issue, because of what somebody over here mentioned. A lot of the government assistance for agricultural development is siphoned off, not only in high salaries for our own people, and we buy services with those dollars from Americans primarily. American technical experts get those salaries and get employment. We also buy American products. Under the law, any American aid for development has to be used, if we produce it in America, to buy American. Did you know that? So a lot of our development aid comes back to benefit us, even though it may benefit somebody else along the way. It benefits us, too. Another problem with that is, with the government aid, is that it has to go government to government. There is no way that the United States, with government dollars, can work in Tanzania without going through the Tanzanian government. Lutheran World Relief can work in Tanzania directly with the people, with the grassroots community, usually some church-related group, because it is not a government agency.
Isn't there a selfish attitude sometimes? Get them off our back, teach them to raise their own corn?
You mean our attitude toward them?
It could be.
Well, yeah, that's there, but there's also the temptation on the part of our economy to want to sell them our own corn, yeah, because we produce more than we need. And there's always the tension. In the farm legislation, there are two things going on. Food for Peace, which is food aid for the, basically over in this column, for the poor and the famine areas, is in the legislation, but so are incentives to develop markets, to sell our grain. And if I had to choose, I would say let's make it so that the poor people can buy our grain rather than depend on our food aid. That would be better. But even better than buying our grain would be to produce their own. Okay? So that's what this column is all about. The long-term consequence of development assistance, it is hoped, will be what? Not dependency, but what?
Self-dependency.
Yeah, self, I think probably a better word is self-reliance. Because self-sufficiency implies too much to me. Let me give you an example. Is Japan self-sufficient in food?
No.
No. Is the United States?
No.
No. Because we import food. We export more value of food than we import, but nevertheless, some foods we have to import if we're going to have them. We are, however, self-reliant in food, and so is Japan. Why? Why can you make that statement?
Because we can afford to import it.
Yeah, we don't depend on aid. We depend on trade. We have something to sell the world in exchange for what we buy in foodstuffs from the world, and so does Japan. Japan is not self-sufficient in energy by any means, neither are we. But thus far, we have been self-reliant in energy. We have a way of getting the energy we need by selling something for it. Okay, so I think self-reliance is the word. That's the goal, that every people be self-reliant in food, even though not every people will produce all of their own food. Most of the poor countries, it is pretty clear, need to produce more than they do. I want to remind you, however, that there are people who are engaged in the first column, giving people the fish, and they're still needed. And one that I think you all know of, because she too is a recent Nobel Prize winner, has said recently, I read this in Lutheran Standard, with a great deal of pride, "I'm the one who gives the fish." She's referring to the proverb and saying there's still a need for people like me who do direct emergency aid. Who is it?
Mother Teresa
in India, who said shortly after she received the Nobel Prize, "I'm the one who gives the fish."
She's not saying there shouldn't be people working to help folks learn how to fish, but she's working in this column.
Now, Luke and Rotary worked in both areas, though, don't you?
Yeah, but I did say that today, about 85% of what LWR and other church agencies like it do with the dollars that we contribute is in column two. So a more adequate name for those agencies would be Lutheran World Development. They continue to use the name Relief because that's what they've had and that's what people are familiar with. But don't let that lead you into thinking that most of what they do is relief. It isn't. Okay, column three. Column three is of a different order than the first two. The first two columns we can pretty well get our heads around, I think. We understand that. We know something about that. Column three we may know a little bit about, but it's much more scary. Because column three is an analysis which comes increasingly from the poor and says the problem is not, basically, famine or lack of food production in our countries. The problem is the global system, which is unjust, which is arranged in such a way that there will be poor and rich countries and that they will always stay that way, unless there's a change. So this problem, this analysis, which I'm giving you now what increasingly the poor nations are saying is the problem. This problem says hunger is caused not by lack of food production, not even basically by inadequate distribution of food in the world, but by poverty. And behind poverty, there are certain structural arrangements between the rich and the poor. So this one would be called unfair systems or unfair arrangements. Another way of talking about this is to say keeping colonies, economic colonies, the rich nations having colonies of the poor nations who are dependent on the rich.
Basically, it's greed then, isn't it?
Well, that's, yeah. It's the old problem that the Bible talks about a great deal, that the reason there are poor people is that the rich rip them off, that the rich keep it that way. God said, when the people came into the land of Israel, there shall be no poor among you. It is not God's will that there be poor, but there always are, and there always are those inequities. And the biblical analysis of that is that it's because the rich do not share, or because the rich create poverty through their unfair structures. Well, let's look at this in terms of today's world, and just think in grand, overgeneralized terms, north and south. We're part of the northern world, basically industrial, affluent. There are pockets of poverty in the northern world too, but in large terms, there are rich nations in the north and poor nations in the south. That breaks down a little bit because Australia and New Zealand are in the south, but they're part of the north in this analysis. So if I say north-south, that's what I'm referring to. The north basically are the lands, the nations, the peoples who once had colonies, political colonies, in the south. The development of new nations in the southern hemisphere, Latin America goes back a little farther, but Asia and Africa is basically since World War II. Most of those lands now have political freedom, with a few exceptions. They claim they do not have economic freedom. They are still our colonies in terms of economics. And their evidence for that, well, we'll talk about some of it, but part of it is what we were on earlier, Christy, that they are locked in to being producers of raw materials for the North. And as long as they are the producers of raw materials only, they'll be like the biblical hewers of wood and drawers of water. They'll be the poor. They'll be the bottom economically. Visual image for this, I guess you could also think internally within a poor country, where very often the problem is inadequate distribution of the land. The large Latin American holdings of land among a few people, maybe 5% of the population having 95% of the land, and the great bulk of people being landless. You could think of land reform. You could think of the wealthy landowner who enjoys all the benefit of the land, and a lot of poor people who just eke out an existence, maybe as sharecroppers. You might have to cartoon it, but something like that might be the way to visualize it. Or the overstuffed, the cartoon image of the bloated, overfilled, overfed northerner who's taking resources from the rest of the world and
Well, wasn't that true with Mexico in 2 years ago when when they revolted?
Yep.
And they
that was over land.
Over land.
Yep.
And they spread it out amongst the poor people.
In the third world countries that have been going on recently have at the center of the issue control of the land. That was true in Nicaragua. It's true now in Guatemala, and there's going to be another revolution there, I think. It was true in Cuba. It has been true in China. Certainly, the Chinese Revolution, at the very heart, was a revolution of the land, of the ownership of the land. And the first thing the new regime did was to redistribute the land, not in private parcels, but in community-held, commune-held parcels. Yeah.
Aren't we seeing just the reverse happening in our own country, where the small farmer is disappearing, and the large corporations
or large family farmers? Yeah. There's a trend in this country that's very discernible toward increased concentration of land, rural land, farmland ownership, among fewer and fewer people. That's really our subject for tomorrow, or part of it, but it's part of the same pattern. And there are some who say, looking 30 years ahead, they're quite concerned that we're going to create a class of landed, wealthy gentry in the United States and be back to where Europe was when many of our immigrant ancestors left. They came here to get land, it was available, and now we're going that same route. The question is what to do about that injustice.
Where does birth control come on in with foreign countries?
Population control?
Yes.
Well, let's say a word about population control. It's pretty clear now, I think, to all observers that population control is a symptom, or a population decline is a symptom, a consequence of addressing the economic problems rather than the other way around.
Well, I just read...
It is not a solution in itself, but it is a result of increased social security or economic security.
China, for the first time, has gone to birth control. It was just in the Seattle Pantry.
They've stepped up their incentives for it, and even made economic incentives. You pay higher taxes if you have a bigger family, and you pay less if you have, you get rewards if you have fewer. China's been very aggressive about population control, but the Chinese also will tell you that it would not have worked in China if they did not have a system that provided economic security and food security for all the people first. Because without economic security, people still want to have big families. There's an economic value in having large families. If you're only, and this is still true in India and many of the developing countries, if your only future security in your old age is children, Joe Bash was talking about this the other day a little bit, if your only security in your old age is children, and particularly male heirs, because the women will marry into somebody else's family, you better not risk having no sons. You better have, and you have to have sons who will live to adulthood. Well, traditionally in many of those countries, half the children would die before the age of five. Maybe half would survive into child-producing ability themselves, years themselves. And I think China is the world's prime example of a large developing country in which they put the two together. Increased economic security for everybody, you're going to get enough to eat in China. And very strict regulation of population growth through incentives. Let's move down the chart here. The need. The need is not for more food now, or for more development, agricultural development. As it says, food isn't the real issue. Economic justice is the issue. And what's the word we use for that? Not more food, but more equity. More equalness. The remedy? Well, fundamental changes in the global system, in the international economic order. What does that mean? It means things like exports and imports, trade. It means who in the world's going to do what. It means, give you a concrete example, again from China. China and the United States have signed a major trade agreement within the past year. It calls for us to buy certain things from China.
It also calls for China to buy certain things they need from us. Do you know what the largest category of commodities we're going to buy from China is? It is not a raw material.
It's processed goods.
What is it? What area would you guess?
Manufacturing.
It's textiles. Exactly. That will benefit China. It will benefit us overall because in trade, both parties benefit if you have more to trade. Who will it hurt in our society, in our economy?
Textile
workers. It'll hurt our textile workers. And they're not very happy about it. But that kind of shift of labor, who in the world does what? The shift of industrial or processing jobs from the northern industrial countries to the southern developing countries is going to go on more and more in our lifetime. And there will be adjustment problems here at home as a result of it.
Chuck?
Yeah.
Does it also mean that we, for instance, have to voluntarily buy, say, fewer bananas, less cane sugar, in an effort to force them, to encourage them to produce food crops instead of cash crops?
I think it means that however it happens, whether we do it voluntarily or whether those countries say, hey, we're not going to use that land to produce for you anymore. The problem with that is, in the short run, it's going to hurt, it's going to disrupt their economies very much because, as Christy was saying, they need something to export in order to buy what they have to import. But there is a discernible and growing shift of labor, of the work that is done by hand, but not raw material production, doing something with the raw material after it's produced, whether it's mined or grown, a shift of jobs in those sectors to the developing countries. And that's going to affect us. And that's why this third column is a little more scary, because anything you do in the third column immediately affects us. Another area of concern here is the behavior of the multinational corporations. That's tied, all tied together. I'm not one who says that they are evil or the villains. I say the global system is the villain. They are a part of it. But basically, their behavior benefits us more than it benefits the people in the low-income countries. I say more than. Don't say it's all black and white. They do provide some jobs, they do provide some development in those countries. But most of those countries thus far have viewed the transnational corporation as more of a problem for them than a solution for them. And what does it mean? I don't think it means they're going to go away. I think it means more regulation, more international agreement on how they shall be regulated. And how much profit can they expropriate from a developing country? It's things like that. How much control will the local, the host country have over their operation in that country? Right now, there's no body of international law that governs the behavior of multinational corporations. And the world community is trying to fashion that. It's very painful, very difficult to do. What else? Well, it means things like who's going to have access to the exploitation of the deep ocean? Not fish now, but minerals. Who does that belong to? I'm talking about the ocean outside the territorial limits of any country. Whose is it?
First come, first serve.
Well, without any law, it will be whoever gets there first to exploit it. And who will that be? It'll be the already rich countries because they have the capital to invest, the know-how, the technology, and the need. The need for the minerals that are there is in our economy. It's not in the economy of Bangladesh. They don't need it. So, what are the poor countries saying about that? What would you expect them to be saying? They're saying that's the common heritage of all humanity. That's part of the common, it's not divided up into national domains yet, and ought not be. So they're saying that, yes, it should be exploited, it should be developed. As it's developed, they should benefit in the development. So the law of the sea negotiations, which have been going on for about a decade, they have had some success in writing agreements that include, well, two elements to benefit the poor countries. One is a tax on all of the mined resource, which will go into an international development fund to benefit the poor countries. The other is there will be an international enterprise, it's called, that will compete with, that will mine along with the private corporations from the rich countries. And what the international enterprise does, its profitability will go also for development. Those kinds of negotiations are going on. It's very slow, very difficult to come to agreements, but there is something happening there. And yet our papers don't tell us much about that. Maybe they think we wouldn't understand it or be interested. Most of their focus on hunger is over here, with maybe a little bit in column two. Well, what texts in the Bible deal with economic justice? What kinds of material do you think of?
Jesus was telling them, aren't the rich the ones that exploit you, and so on.
Okay. Some of the words of Jesus.
Start with Genesis and work out through Revelation.
What Old Testament material in particular, body of material, would you mention?
All the prophetic material.
Many of the prophets, the Old Testament prophets. Which are very hard words on the rich. That Isaiah passage I mentioned begins with, you fast and think you'll win my favor by fasting, and yet you continue to oppress your workers. How can you fast and claim favor with God while you oppress your workers? It's addressed to the employer's parent. And then God says, the kind of fasting I appreciate is that you share your bread and break the chains, the yokes of oppression. Objects of study here, we've already mentioned some of them.
Economics.
Yeah, certainly international economics. And how was the system put together and who does it benefit? The role of multinationals, what is a fair price for the raw materials of the poor? It's really an issue very much like that of the American farmer's issue. What is a fair price for wheat, for a bushel of wheat? What is parity? If you know farm economics at all, you know what parity is all about. That kind of language. The poor countries are saying there's a parity issue with regard to their raw material exports in relation to what they have to import.
What's a fair price for a barrel of oil?
Okay, see, the oil-producing countries have dealt with this unilaterally, haven't they? Why have they gotten away with it? They've simply said, oil is worth this much, we're going to charge it. If you want it, that's what you pay. Why have they been able to get away with that?
Because we've got to have it.
But why do we have to buy it? Can we say no thanks?
Because
we're addicted. We're hooked on it. We need it. Okay. Some of the other raw materials, like bauxite, they've formed associations too and talked about doing the same thing, but it hasn't worked as well. One reason is there are more ready substitutes for some of those other products. The chocolate-producing countries have talked about it, but when chocolate prices get too high, we turn to substitutes. We use less. When coffee prices get too high, we do the same. They're trying to develop in the international arena ways of setting fair prices for products in terms of purchasing power. Rubber, take rubber. A ton of rubber from Malaysia this year buys about one-third as much on the international industrial market as it bought 15 years ago. So the poor countries are losing ground all the time in terms of the market basket of things they need to import. So that's an issue. It's called the terms of trade. And keeping the terms of trade, that is the prices of products, in some kind of balance between raw material and processed goods. Yeah?
Well, what alternative do the oil-producing countries have outside of their oil? I mean, if we were to use it all.
Well, that's basically what they're saying.
What do they have left?
That's what they're saying. The only thing they have to sell in the international marketplace is oil.
So if we use it, if we don't use it wisely, if we misuse it, then they have nothing, and we will find they have nothing. Yeah.
They're not only putting a price on it that is higher and higher, they are putting
that's
a limit on how much they produce each year.
That's the only alternative they have.
That's right.
By price.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking, too, that we're leaving God out of this a little bit, that it's not really, but I mean, the picture can change. Now, Iran was one of our poorer countries. Look at it now, though. They mm-hmm. found oil mm-hmm. there, yeah. And I remember when Iran was poor.
Yeah.
And so that things, you know, as things are found in, or you know,
yeah.
things develop in different countries, that they may find something, so that the picture changes.
That's right. That's right.
What is the biggest product in food that we produce in the United States?
For export or total?
Total.
Well,
wheat,
it's cereal grains.
Yes,
collectively,
wheat,
it's cereal grains, including
but
wheat.
Isn't the biggest product in the world is rice?
More people eat rice than wheat, that's true.
That's right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's hard for them to change over into the wheat. Now, we had a fellow from India spoke to us, and they got to talking about the large amount of wheat that we were exporting over to them. And he said, for our use? No. He said, we're storing that wheat for you. He said, we're relieving you, the Commodity Credit Corporation, that is charging you here, the American farmers, for storage. And he said, we're storing it over there for your charge. And he says, it's molding in there.
Yeah, I know that India now has large wheat reserves, but there are many parts of India where wheat is consumed, and they produce a lot of wheat themselves.
Yes.
And other parts of India where they eat rice. As you move north, the Chinese are primarily rice eaters, but there are also wheat regions in China, historically, where they grow wheat farther north. But yeah, a lot of it means some change in diet for some people, and that's happened, and we've promoted that so that they'd learn to eat what we have to sell them.
But there's somewhere on that, there's also the waste that this that,
I think that's really part of column two.
Yes.
The infrastructure for agriculture needs to have storage facilities, farm-to-market roads, all of those things as well. Let me quickly wrap this up by suggesting that the motive or value that goes here is not now compassion, sharing, charity, but justice. This is about justice more than about charity. The long-term consequence, if these shifts occur, that the poor countries are ganging up on us to demand, will be a shift of power and wealth, a redistribution of power and wealth in the world. That is the result, as it has already happened with OPEC. There has been a shift, a discernible shift of power and wealth because of what they've done with the price of their raw material. Finally, variation on the proverb, we have to invent it. Here we say you teach a person to fish and here we say you teach a person to fish and he can be fed for many tomorrows. Here it would be something like, let the fisherman have a market for selling his excess catch at a fair price and stop polluting his waters upstream. Okay, some kind of saying like that is what this third column deals with. Now I think you can see why it's much easier for us to operate and support efforts in the first two columns, because they don't threaten us so much. But if you work at the third column, Lutheran World Relief doesn't, most of the churches don't do much in this area yet, even educationally. This is going to change us. And that's more political, that's more scary, and that's likely to have more impact on our own lifestyles.